Okay, good. Thank you. Okay. I don't know what exactly. Thank you very much, Venerable Anna Vihari, for doing the introduction. I have no idea what you said. I hope it was nice. But anyway, I'm sure it's very nice. Bhante, is there anything that I should say at the beginning? Anything that needs, is everything kind of organized? Yeah. Okay. Everybody knows about the schedule and all those kind of things? Okay. That's all organized. Okay. Good. Okay, so I just came from Poronaruva today. I was just there for one day, 26 hours to be precise. And it's always very nice to come to Sri Lanka when you come from Australia. In Sri Lanka, there's all this kind of ancient culture, right, been going on for thousands of years. But in Australia, of course, there is almost nothing. Everything is so new. So when you come to Sri Lanka, you get this connection with history, connection with the past, connection with a long time ago. And that's very, very nice and very beautiful. And in addition to that, also Sri Lanka is also physically and also vegetation-wise very different from Australia. Australia is very dry, there's sand everywhere, there's desert everywhere. You come to Sri Lanka, it's green and wonderful and beautiful. And I must admit, when you come from Australia, it's very nice to come to a place which is so green. So for that reason, I really enjoyed being here so far. I've enjoyed when I was here last time, and it's always a pleasure to be in Sri Lanka. How much should I speak before you translate? Is there any rules about that? Or? So after the whole talk, yeah. Okay, good. So one of the nice things also about going to Poronaruva is the fact that you get this feeling of Buddhist history. One of the things that you notice when you go there is that you see many of the events of Buddhist history. You see it before your eyes. For example, today we went to the Sima. The Sima is the place where monks get ordained, where you do the Patimokkha together. And there was an ancient Sima there that was almost 1,000 years old. And you can see that the way the Sima was constructed in Poronaruva in those days is exactly the way it is described in the commentaries, right? It's 1,000 years old. You have like an inner Sima, then you have an interval, and then you have the Sima, the external Sima outside. So you can see how these things are, today is exactly the same way it was 1,000 years ago, and you can see kind of how these things have been working throughout history. And one of the things that you also see when you go to Poronaruva is you see the ancient inscriptions by the kings of that time. And some of those ancient inscriptions, they talk about the problems in the Sasana, the difficulties for the Sangha getting corrupt, right? And there still being a few monks around who kind of are pure, and then how the king has to step in. This was a very famous Sri Lankan king, Parakramabahu the first, who then sorted out the Sangha and took away, made sure that those monks who were too corrupt, they were disrobed, etc., etc. And this is one of the things that you see throughout Buddhist history, is how the Sangha and how the Sasana kind of goes in waves, right? Things go well and things get corrupted. Then somebody has to step in, somebody has to make changes to things. And it goes in waves like this throughout history. And today we're also somewhere in this wave. Not sure exactly where we are, but we are somewhere on this wave as well. And when you see these waves throughout history, and you see the corruption that has been going on, then it automatically leads you to the question, where did all this start? Is there any purity? Is there any real teaching that we can ultimately rely on as the real teachings? Where does all this come from? And of course, as Buddhists, there's one thing that we always have to rely on. There's one thing that always has to be kind of the essential aspect of the Buddhist teaching, of Buddhism, really. And that, of course, is the teaching of the Buddha himself. As a Buddhist, there's one thing that we have to have faith in, have confidence in, and that is the fact that the Buddha was awakened. If you don't think the Buddha was awakened, everything collapses. There's nothing there. Everything is kind of gone. This is kind of the basis of faith in the Buddhist in Buddhism. And of course, once you realize that this is the kind of the core of Buddhism, is having faith in the Buddha, understanding who the Buddha was, then of course the question arises: well, what did the Buddha teach, right? What are his teachings? Can we know with any certainty what the Buddha actually taught us. And of course, this is one of the crucial things, one of the reasons why I like to, when I teach, I like to teach directly from the suttas, directly from the word of the Buddha, because I like to go back and see, well, what is the gold standard in Buddhism? What is the foundation upon which everything else in Buddhism rests? Whether it is Buddhism in Sri Lanka, whether it is Buddhism in any other Theravada country, but not just Theravada country, also in the Mahayana countries, there are certain aspects of the teaching that are more ancient than others. All of Buddhism ultimately rests on the same thing, and that is the teachings of the Buddha. So unless we go back to that, unless we read that, we don't have any standard, we don't have any foundation by which to decide this is the real thing, these are the authentic teachings, this is what really matters, this is what everything else should be measured up against. And of course we know today, we know through scholarship that has been going on for a very long time, and I think today the results of this scholarship are becoming more clear all the time, year after year, decade after decade, and we know with a fair degree of certainty what those teachings are. And essentially, the result is very mundane and very ordinary. The result is that those teachings is essentially what you find in the four main Nikayas of Buddhism. That is really what we can say with a fair amount of certainty. This is roughly what the Buddha's teachings are. Of course, that is not 100% precise. There are other things as well which count as the Buddha's teachings, such as parts of the Vinayapitaka. It certainly comes directly from the Buddha, the Patimokkha rules, some of the Sangha Kammas that we do as monastics in the present day. All of this is also part of the Buddha's teachings. And sometimes there are some of the suttas that there are good grounds for doubting whether it came from the Buddha. But roughly speaking, if you look at the four main Nikayas, Digha Nikaya, Majjhima Nikaya, Sanghita Nikaya, and Anguttara Nikaya, if you read that, you're not going to be far away from what the Buddha himself taught 2,500 years ago. So it's powerful stuff. So when you open those books, you are reading the Buddha's word, right? Like the Buddha is talking directly to you. And this is the beautiful thing about this. If you get inspired by these teachings, you're getting inspired as a real and direct and immediate disciple of the Buddha himself. It's very powerful and very beautiful when you think about this in the right way. So this is what I will be focusing on this retreat, trying to look at some of the earliest teachings of the Buddha. What did the Buddha actually teach? I want to look at it in a little bit of comparative perspective. These days we also know that the suttas, the teachings of the Buddha, were also preserved in languages like Chinese. Some of them were preserved in Sanskrit, some of them preserved in the Tibetan language. And sometimes it's very useful to compare different suttas through different recensions. And it gives a better understanding of what the suttas actually were like originally. So these are some of the things I want to do. And my main focus on this retreat is going to be on the Noble Eightfold Path. Last time I was in Sri Lanka 2 years ago, I taught the gradual training, which also is very beautiful and very nice, but this time I want to have a slightly different approach, just to bring in some different suttas, bring in some different angles on how to look at this whole path of Buddhism. And of course, the beautiful thing about the Noble Eightfold Path is that it shows you the whole training, right, from the very beginning, all the way to the end. What I think is so important with this is that even though for those people who already have done meditation for a long time, who have a lot of understanding perhaps of the deeper aspects of meditation, even who get some access to some samadhi, even for people like that, it is important to focus on the earlier stages of the path, because it is the earlier stages of the path that again produce this platform upon which the rest of the path blossoms. It comes into being because the foundation is strong. The foundation is always important, and as long as you improve that foundation, you can also expect the later stages of the path to become more powerful. So for that reason, I think it's important to teach the whole path, teach everything. And as you teach everything, you give everybody, no matter how good a meditator you are, you give them a better foundation for going even further in your practice. So that is going to be the focus on that on this retreat. I hope you approve of that. And if you don't, well, it's still going to be the focus. So you might as well approve of it. So this is going to be my main focus. And now I want to. That is all I want to say today. Tomorrow morning we're going to start. We're looking at the suttas directly and start to focus on the various aspects of the path. But for tonight, instead of actually starting with this tonight, I'm going to start off tonight with just teaching some very basic and simple things about meditation. And the things that I'm going to teach about meditation, very, very basic things, are the sort of things I would like people to focus on during this retreat. You can focus on whatever you like. Don't have to focus on these things. But these are the kind of things I usually emphasize when I teach meditation. So everybody is free to do whatever you like, of course, but this is just the way I normally explain these things. And also, I should say that it is really up to you whether you want to come to these meditations. I'm going to do a little bit of guided meditation every day. Don't want to come to guided meditation, that's fine. If you don't want to come to the talks in the evening, that's fine as well. It's really up to you. You can come to whatever you like. As far as I'm concerned, I think it's important to have that freedom. If you feel one day that you'd rather just meditate, if you feel one day that you're tired for whatever reason, if something doesn't feel right, please do whatever you feel is right for you to do. Everybody has to take responsibility for their own practice. And this is a way of learning to take that responsibility to do what you think actually works for you. So, I'm going now to just talk a few words about meditation practice. And one of the most important things for me with meditation is to learn to enjoy the meditation. This is so fundamental and so important that you basically enjoy yourself as you go along. This doesn't mean that every second of the retreat is going to be enjoyable. There's always little problems that have to be overcome. There's always obstacles, there's always problems with the body. The physical body gives endless problems in this life. But what it means that the general trend, the general feeling of the retreat is one of contentment, right? You feel at ease, you feel relaxed, you feel good about yourself. That should be the general feeling during this retreat. And I will ask you, if you have that at the back of your mind, all the way through this retreat, you think about that, it should be a sense of ease, then I think it will kind of give you a sense of guidance to help you resolve any issues that arise, any problems that arise, and then you will kind of be heading in the right direction. So keep that in the back of your mind. This is the way I like to look at meditation practice. And it is difficult enough already to live the monastic life, right? You have enough restrictions already. At least when we meditate, it should be something that we enjoy, something where we can kind of escape a little bit from all the troubles and the difficulties of the world. Now, to be able to enjoy meditation practice, one of the very basic things, this is of course the very first teaching of the Buddha, and I think is a teaching that is often perhaps not put enough into practice, and that is the teaching of the middle way, the Majjhima Patipada, right? The middle way of practice. And this is the very first thing the Buddha teaches after his awakening. You have it in the Dhammacakkappavattana Sutta. The very first thing he says is, bhikkhus, you should not pursue the Attakkilamatthana Yoga. You should not pursue the indulgence and sensual pleasures. You should find this middle way. And it is important that this has very practical and very immediate consequences for our practice. And one of the, of course, for me, one of the important lessons from this is that we don't practice in a way whereby we produce too much pain in the pain in the body. This is really the first thing. First thing, don't produce unnecessary pain in the body. The body is difficult enough as it is. And if we produce, if we deliberately sit down with lots of pain in the body, it means that basically we are doing a type of Attakkilamatthana Yoga. This is what the whole thing is about, right? In the Buddha's life, before he was the Buddha to be, this is one of the things he rejected, was the deliberate promotion, if you like, of pain in the physical body. That is what the Jain practice was all about. And then he says to the first five monks, this doesn't work. this actually is not the way to awakening here. And what is so astonishing to me is to see in the present day, even though this is kind of our root teacher here, this is the very first teaching, right? If it is the very first teaching of something, it means that it is important. It is the basis, perhaps, upon which a lot of the other teachings is founded. Despite that, despite this very simple, beautiful, direct teaching at the very beginning, what you find in the Buddhist world today is that a lot of people don't actually heed that. And still, in my opinion at least, they sit with too much pain. They force themselves to sit down over very long periods of time. They don't necessarily have a comfortable posture. And because of that, what are the results of that? Well, one of the results of that is that people sometimes disrobe. Progress in meditation stops. It was too difficult to live the monastic life. And you end up disrobing as a result. I have seen this happen many, many times in my life as a monk. And for lay people, it is a similar kind of thing here. You may not disrobe because you can't really disrobe, but you stop meditating, right? You have all this pain, and you think, well, I don't want to. I've got enough problems in life already. I don't need to make Buddhism to make me even more problems. Buddhism is supposed to be about happiness, about getting rid of suffering, and it's creating even more suffering. Forget about that. Throwing out meditation, not being interested in it anymore. And this is something I've seen also on a number of occasions in my life, lay people entirely giving up the path of meditation because of the difficulties of the whole process. And it is a tragedy, really, because the path of meditation, the path of Buddhism, the Eightfold Path, all the things we do, they have such an incredible potential to transform our lives, to get rid of suffering, to give rise to all kinds of degrees of happiness. The potential is so enormous. And because we don't heed the most simple, the most basic teachings of the Buddha, because we don't heed that, we end up throwing away the whole lot. That whole beautiful potential that the path has just gets thrown out as a consequence. So please remember that. And I don't have any problem if all of you want to sit on chairs. That's perfectly fine with me. I know many monks who use chairs in the meditation practice because they have destroyed their knees through too long, prolonged sitting without really being able to do so. There's no shame in sitting on a chair, at least sometimes, right? Even all the time, if that is required. The most important thing is to be comfortable. Most important thing is not whether you sit cross-legged, whether you sit in any old posture. There's one very famous monk I knew about, and he's very famous for having very, very good samadhi. He was a Thai monk, and he would always lie down in meditation, right? That was his posture, always lying down. And he was asked, why do you lie down? Well, because it is easier to relax when you lie down than when you sit upright. And when you are 100% relaxed, that is when it is easy to enter samadhi, right? But don't you fall asleep? No, I don't fall asleep, because falling asleep, then I would be doing something. But I don't do anything at all. I'm just aware, right? Just awake. That's what he said. So please keep that in mind. It's about being relaxed, being at ease. Pasu vihara is kind of the Pali word for this. And then you are moving in the right direction. Please don't create more obstacles for yourself than there is already. It's already difficult enough, right? We have to deal with all these hindrances, deal with all the problems in life. That is hard enough. So this is very basic advice, but incredibly important, and very often it is flaunted. People are not actually listening to some of these most, not that they're not listening, but they haven't really perhaps fully contemplated the importance of these very basic teachings. So that is the first one. Make sure you're comfortable in the physical body. The next one, once the body is kind of, there's no pains there and you're reasonably comfortable, the next thing to do in a meditation is to make sure that you are relaxed, that the body is at ease, that you have no tensions, that there are no kind of little things that are problematic in the body. And what I would recommend you to do, this is the way I like to do meditation myself, is to always start off by focusing on the body, feeling the body, feeling the whole thing, feeling where there is any problem, feeling where there is any kind of remaining pain, feeling where there is any kind of tension, and spending time to relax, 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 till the body is so relaxed that it almost disappears completely by itself. right? This is what happens when the body becomes incredibly relaxed. The body is not the problem anymore. And when the body is not the problem anymore, it becomes very light. It becomes like a feather. And it tends to kind of disappear into the background. And actually, I would ask you to notice that. Sometimes we need to notice these very basic and simple things. But take note of the feeling of the body when it's incredibly relaxed. It's quite delightful, right? It feels good. And the deeper that relaxation is, if you focus on the body enough, you can take the depth of relaxation to new levels all the time. And I'm sure many of you will have noticed that whenever you come out of a fairly deep state of meditation, you feel incredibly relaxed afterwards. But here we're trying to take that relaxation to a deeper level even before you start watching the breath, even before you start doing any formal meditation practice. And by doing that, you're kind of establishing yourself. You're establishing that depth, that sense of ease in the body beforehand, and that ease is your way into deeper states of meditation afterwards. So this is the second thing. Feel the body. Allow the body to become more comfortable than it has ever been before. And one of the aspects of feeling the body, you may think that this is all too much focus on the physical body. But the reality is that when you're focusing on the physical body, you're also focusing on the mind. And the reason for that is because most of the displeasure and the problems in the body, they come originally, they start out in the mind, right? It's the mind that controls the body. If you have tension somewhere because you have been pushing yourself too much, almost all the time it comes from the mind. It's the mind that controls the body. So by focusing on the body in this way, not only is the body becoming comfortable, but the mind too is kind of gradually becoming comfortable. So it's an indirect way of kind of working with the mind for allowing the body to calm down and to become peaceful in this way. So these things go together, mind and body, beautifully working together in this way. So it's actually an indirect way of dealing with the mind itself. And what is happening here while you do this is that because the body feels very comfortable, because the mind is starting to relax, you're starting to feel at ease, right? You're starting to feel nice where you're sitting. You're starting to feel already a very basic form of pleasure where you are. This is what's happening here. You're starting to feel nice where you're sitting. And what happens when you start to feel nice? What happens is that the mind gets drawn automatically into the present moment. One of the main reasons that it's hard to be mindful, one of the main reasons is because the present moment is not nice, right? Especially if you have a lot of pain in the body. Actually, the mind wants to wander off. It wants to go into the past, wants to go into the future, wants to fantasize about this, fantasize about that, precisely because the present moment is not nice. So unless you have incredibly good samadhi already, so that you are able to focus on the pain, it's a waste of time focusing on pain at the early stages of the practice. So instead, you make the present moment beautiful. You make it pleasant. And when the present moment becomes pleasant, then mindfulness comes all by itself. You can see here how this becomes a natural process. The pleasure of the present moment makes mindfulness possible. So this is how the whole thing kind of happens, stage by stage. One of the important aspects of this path is, of course, your attitude to what you're doing. To be able to relax the body and to relax the mind and to feel a sense of pleasure and to feel a sense of ease, your attitude is really the fundamental issue. So, what do we mean by attitude? What we mean by attitude is how you relate to yourself. How do you relate to your body? How do you relate to your mind? How do you even relate to the people around you? And when the attitude is one of being gentle, one of being compassionate, one of being kind to yourself, kind to everything else, one of being one that lets go of things, in the world, but especially in the beginning, one of gentleness and kindness. This is kind of the basic attitude that we're supposed to have. And if you can build up that attitude of gentleness and kindness as this progress, as you kind of calm down, as you focus on the body, as you make the body more peaceful, if you can build up that attitude as well, you will find that that is always one of the most powerful ways of finding that ease in both the body and the mind. That kindness, that gentleness is what allows you to let go, right? You're no longer controlling it because you're kind and gentle. You have a sense of metta, loving kindness towards yourself. And metta is the opposite of control. It is the idea of letting go. So this is one of the things that we want to encourage as you do this whole process. And the more powerful that kindness and gentleness is inside of you, the more powerful becomes the pleasure that you experience right here and right now. And therefore, also, the more powerful is the mindfulness as a consequence. And when you do this, there comes a point when the body kind of fades into the background and you feel very naturally in the present moment. The present moment is quite easy, right? You kind of feel that the thinking mind has almost faded completely away. There's still a little bit of thought here, a little bit of thought there, but not very much. And once you see that mindfulness has arisen, that mindfulness is the foundation for all practice of meditation. In the Anapanasati Sutta, those of you who know the suttas, it always says, satting upatapetva, right? Having established mindfulness, then you practice Anapanasati. Not before that is established. That has to come first. So once you feel that mindfulness has arisen, then that is the right time to watch the breath. You have a sense of pleasure inside of yourself, a sense of kindness and gentleness. You feel at ease, you feel relaxed. The mind is just natural in the present moment. Then you wait for the breath to come to you. And then when the breath comes to you, because the breath is always there in the present moment, right? The breath is part of the experience of the present moment. So then when the breath is there, the breath comes to you, you just very, very gently do you allow your attention to rest on the breath. Don't grasp the breath. Don't hold on to it. No willpower. No need to use your volition or anything like that. All you do, you just wait. And then you allow the breath just to exist in the present moment together with your awareness. And if you can do that much, if you're able to watch the breath in a way where the breath is easy, where the breath is relaxed, where the breath is a pleasure to watch rather than something that you are holding on to and grasping on to, then you're already going a long way in the right direction. And then we get to the beginning of the Anapanasati Sutta, where you're watching the long breath and you're watching the short breath, etc., as it says there. So this is really the foundation for meditation practice. If you get to that point, watching the breath is relatively easy. Of course, even then, you tend to lose the breath, right? You watch the breath and it disappears again. And if it disappears, then go back to the beginning. Make sure you haven't got any tensions in the body. Of course, as your meditation progresses, you can go through the early stages very, very fast, right? You can feel that your body is really relaxed in 2 seconds and you can move on. So these things are all relative to where you are on the path. But you go back to the beginning, because sometimes if you get disturbed, some tension can arise again. And then go back to the breath. And then stay with the breath. And allow the breath again to be there completely naturally. No force, right? Just gently, nicely. This very gentle awareness placed on the breathing process. And as you keep on repeating this again and again, eventually you come to the point where the whole process of Anapanasati starts to happen. One of the things that I will focus on during this retreat is to focus on ways to help us give rise to some of the joy and happiness, some of the things that actually makes this whole process take off. Remember that one of the reasons, especially for the lay people here, one of the reasons that we keep the 8 precepts on the retreat like this is because the 8 precepts are a support for the meditation practice. And this, I think, is also important for the monastics to remember, is that precepts in Buddhism, the idea of the Patimokkha precepts or the 8 precepts for the lay people, the idea is not just to restrain yourself from doing the bad things in life, but the idea is actually to deliberately cultivate goodness. And this is so important to remember, because on the one hand, yes, of course, it is absolutely foundational to restrain yourself from doing the bad. If you don't do that, you're not going to get anywhere. But on the other hand, the other side of the coin, the idea of doing good, that is what often what boosts the mind, makes the mind bright, makes the mind energetic. Energy comes from the goodness that we do to each other, to the animals of the world, the things that we just think in our mind. This is where brightness and energy comes from. So please remember that. And I think this is important, just as important for monastics as it is for lay people. If you do the positive things in life, if you do are kind to the people around you, if you are generous to the people around you, if you have a sense of metta to people, that is the thing which is going to give the brightness that makes meditation possible. And sometimes it's astonishing, the small little things that we do in the world that can be powerful. I remember doing this was at Bodhinyana Monastery in Perth, and I was doing a retreat, and I was, you know, it was quite peaceful and everything was nice. And sometimes, you know, you see the opportunity to do something nice. And I remember this one day, all I was doing, I was in the bathroom, and I was going to the toilet. And as I was going to the toilet, I saw an insect in the toilet, a poor insect lying on its back, right? Of course, I could have ignored that insect, I could have let it be, I could have gone to another cubicle, I could have done whatever. But there was nobody around, I was the only person in this whole bathroom, this was during a retreat time. And suddenly I got this strong feeling that I have to help this poor little being, right? Sometimes it is very strange, and especially when there's nobody around, there's no precept that you have to keep. And so I took a piece of toilet paper and I fished out this little insect from this toilet. That's all I did, right? It's a very little thing, and it's something that probably many of us do all the time. And I took it nicely outside and put it down outside. But maybe because your mind is sensitive, because you're on retreat. But a little thing like that gave me a lot of joy. It was this feeling that you're protecting life, protecting living beings. A small little thing that has so much power. And I think if you do similar kind of thing, especially now that you are on retreat, right? Don't forget to be kind to the people around you while you're on this retreat. And if you have kindness to the people around you, you're actually boosting your chances of getting some good meditation right here and right now. And this is the important thing. Kindness, especially while you're meditating, is very important because it has an immediate consequence on your meditation practice. And so please do that. Please have metta for each other. Have a sense of karuna for each other. Have a sense of kindness for each other. And when you have that, this is a very important part of the precepts. Most of these precepts are about kindness and goodness. And if you actually apply that, especially during the meditation retreat, you are improving your chances of getting some nice meditation while we are here. Okay, so that is just some very brief introduction to you. So please, you're of course welcome to meditate in whatever way you like. This is how I often introduce the meditation practice. And now, shall we do a little bit of guided meditation, Bandhisattva Mahasadhyaya? Yeah? So let's just do a little bit of guided meditation together for half an hour or so. And then after that, we can maybe do the translation. Okay, so this will be a fairly short meditation, so about half an hour or so. So just make sure that you sit nice and comfortably. First of all, always start off feeling the body. Make sure you don't have any unnecessary pains or problems, first of all. And close your eyes and just feel that your posture and everything is right. Once you are reasonably comfortable in the body, then feel the body, make sure that you are at ease, that you are relaxed. We have all traveled quite long today. And after traveling, there's always some little problems in the physical body here. So feel the physical body here. And especially if you find any tension anywhere, just imagine yourself breathing in through that place. And as you breathe in, and as you allow the breath to go out, relax. Relax 100%. And please take some time at these earlier stages of meditation. I think one of the biggest problems in meditation practice is going to the breath too early. And if you go too early, it becomes tense, it becomes unpleasant, it does not become natural at all. So allow yourself the time every time you sit down, just to relax, feel the body. Keep on feeling any tensions, any displeasure in the body, and just by putting a kind and gentle attention on that place, allow yourself to relax. Kindness and gentleness. please stay with the body for an hour. Don't move on too fast to any other aspect of meditation. Keep on feeling the body, especially in the first few days, just to allow yourself to get a deep foundation for the rest of the retreat. Make sure you are 100% relaxed. Keep on focusing on the body with gentleness and kindness, allowing it to calm down and find ease. And you know, just keep on doing this until the body becomes like feather light. It almost kind of disappears completely. And it's that pleasure of the body that arises as a consequence. And just keep on staying with the body here. And if you find that there are areas that are difficult to relax, that where there is pain remaining or whatever, then send yourself a little bit of metta, a little bit of compassion. And this can be done very easily by just saying to yourself and saying to your body, thank you, body. Thank you for all your services. All the things that you have done for me over such a long time. Now I will look after you. May you be happy. May you relax. May you be at ease. if you find that your mind drifts off, and just very gently bring it back to the body again, and just continue the awareness of the body, feeling if there is any way you can relax even further. And the idea here is to bring the body to a state where it is so light and so comfortable, and you feel really at ease, and the body becomes nothing. It fades into the background, and the focus of the mind arises instead. Gradually, as you relax in a deeper way than you have for a long time, perhaps, then feel the pleasure of that. Feel the delight in just having a completely relaxed body. This is usually the first benefit of meditation, is that you feel this good being inside of yourself, being inside of your body. gradually, as you practice in this way, as you're letting go of the control of the body, as you're feeling the ease of the body, you can see that mindfulness arises stage by stage, all by itself. There's nothing you have to do, there's nothing you have to control. All you have to do is to enjoy the experience of relaxing and letting go. And that enjoyment in itself is enough. The letting go of the dukkha, the suffering, and the arising of pleasure is enough for mindfulness to arise. And when mindfulness starts to arise, just enjoy that. Enjoy that peace of being at ease in the present without taking it any further for now. to experience that beautiful sense of just resting in the present moment, just that feeling of having nothing to do at all, anywhere, no work, no house, no chores, there's nothing you have to do except sitting right here, right now. And that feeling of just resting in the present moment, without having anything to do, no willpower, no doing needs to be exerted. There's something very powerful and beautiful about that. Get into that feeling. Feel the beauty and feel the power. Each time you see the delight of meditation, the more powerful becomes the practice. We're now coming to the end of this short meditation, and as always, I'd like you to reflect back on what has happened over the last half an hour, and try to understand the process of how meditation works. In particular, think about what you have let go of, and what perception, what thoughts, what view of the world you have developed over this past half an hour. And as you see that, you start to understand the process of how the calming of the mind actually happens. Okay, so that's the end of the meditation, so please come out if you like. Okay. Okay, so that's all for this evening, I believe. So I will leave you at this point, so please we continue with the translation or whatever.